You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Director of the John Cage Trust, and this week's program will once again be a conversation with Robert Warby, a composer, sound artist, and broadcaster based in London. Warby was my guest last week, and we focused on his 2012 recording with Sub Rosa of John Cage's Songbooks. This week, we focus on the works comprising his 2014 Sub Rosa recording entitled John Cage's Early Electronic and Tape Pieces, which comprises Cage's Fontana Mix with Aria, Imaginary Landscape No. 5, WBAI, Cartridge Music, 0 Minutes 0 Seconds, otherwise known as 433 No. 2, and his Variations 1. Amazing stuff. So, Robert, welcome back to All Things Cage. You're two in a row, which is unique.
Absolutely. A great privilege, Laura. A great privilege to be on the program.
Thank you so much, Robert. I thought that today we're going to focus on your really long-standing interest in Cage's works that involve electronics and tape, and then more specifically move into the works you've chosen for your Sub Rosa CD from 2014, John Cage's Early Electronic and Tape Works. That, of course, covers works from the early 1950s through 1962, I think, is your last one.
I think it's 1960, Cartridge Music.
No, 0 minutes, 0 seconds.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
1962.
Exactly.
In Japan, exactly.
We'll break format tonight by interspersing these works into our conversation so that Robert can address each one, what was special about it for him. The works are in this order from the CD, information about which is on the broadcast page, is Fontana Mix with Aria, Imaginary Landscape No. 5, WBAI, Cartridge Music, and 0 minutes and 0 seconds.
And Variations 1.
And Variations 1. Is on this recording?
Six pieces.
Marvelous. I'm so glad you corrected me. I did not remember that. Okay. And Variations 1 has become a very important piece for you over the years, has it not?
Indeed. Yeah.
These works are all, as I said, on a Sub Rosa CD from 2014 that were realized and performed by Robert with the Langham Research Center.
Correct.
Which is not a real place. I like to say that because people look it up. They can't believe it's not a center. They want to go there and study what you do. The Langham Research Center is a group devoted to authentic performances of classic electronic music and the creation of new music from their instrumentarium of vintage analog devices. And as I say, no such place actually exists. You've been performing with Langham for a long time, no?
Yeah, I can't remember when the ensemble originally formed, but I've been working with Langham Research Center well over 10 years.
Okay, so let's just, do you want to start at the top and just talk about the pieces one at a time? And as I said, we'll break for each one after each conversation, and I'll play either the entire piece, if it's a short one, or an excerpt at whatever time allows us to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Perfect. So Fontana Mix with Aria. Let's talk about that. That's actually become it's a favorite of audiences with regard to Cage's work, those two works together. That is not one piece, by the way. So everybody needs to understand there's Fontana Mix, and then it's used as a kind of, for lack of a better way to put it, Cage would cringe, as a kind of backdrop for Aria, which is so splashy and wonderful.
Absolutely. And he used the score of Fontana Mix to create Aria when he was in Milan in 1958. I first heard this work, Fontana Mix, when I was a teenager on a record of electronic music, along with other pieces by people like Mimaragalu and Berio, I think. There was a piece by Berio. And when I first heard it, it was utterly baffling. I just could not understand what this was about. I was instantly curious about it. And then years later, I discovered there was a score, which is entirely graphic, of course, and it involves transparent plastic sheets with dots and wiggly lines and a grid and all kinds of devices, and it was just fascinating. The look of this score was absolutely amazing. And what's more, I realized that I could do it. This was absolutely incredible. Looking at the score of Music of Changes, written at, 6 years earlier, I can't play Music of Changes. I can't do that, but I can realize Fontana Mix, which is why I was attracted to it. And I made my first realization in 1987, a long, long time ago. And it took 3 months. It's a big piece. It's a lot of work. And then when the Langham Research Center began to look for things to do, look for great modernist works that we might be able to realize ourselves, I immediately thought of Fontana Mix and so made another realization of it. I had copies of John's original tapes. He made 4 tapes when he made his realization in 1958. I had copies of those. So they were my source material. That's what I originally used. And then I added to that other devices that we had, other sounding devices, electronic, concrete, amplification of small sounds, all archetypal cage devices. And one of my guiding principles for this realization was that I was only going to use the resources that John would have had in 1958.
Wow.
So, we don't use any digital devices, for example, because they weren't available. Right. We didn't use any synthesizers.
This is quite a feat.
this is what Langham Research Center do. We use quarter-inch tape machines. We use sine tone oscillators. We use shortwave radios. We use phonograph cartridges, all of those devices. And so this was perfect. This was absolutely perfect for the Langham Research Center. And we made this realization specifically for this recording. I'm acutely aware that John was not interested in recordings particularly. When I visited him in 1988, I handed him recordings that I'd made. He thanked me very much. He took the cassette from me, and I'm sure he just put it in a cupboard and forgot about it.
They went into a box. So we had 3 boxes in the cupboard, in the closet, in the front room.
Right.
One was for music. One was for nature, which included, of course, mushrooms. And one was for literature and poetry. And those were to be sent off to their respective archives.
Okay. Well, maybe that tape that I gave him in 88 is in an archive somewhere. So this was something we could do. Again, it was entirely pragmatic. I admire the pragmatism of the experimental music tradition, of John's pragmatism. Particularly, when you see those great photographs of him on tour with Merce Cunningham in colleges in remote towns in America where they arrive, they haven't got the equipment they were promised, the resources are not available, but those guys get on and put on a show that night. They absolutely make things work with whatever resources they have to hand. And that pragmatism I greatly admired. So we made this realization for this recording, and we decided that we would include aria, and we worked with a soprano, mezzo-soprano Catherine Carter, with whom we'd been working. She did fabulous performances of aria, and we recorded the two pieces simultaneously, as would be in a performance.
Right.
So Catherine was in a separate booth. She was in a separate booth, but we could hear her, and we made several recordings and chose the one we liked the sound of best. And it was as simple as that.
Lovely, lovely. This is the piece aria for our listening audience. Aria was the piece that was really sort of concretized in its popularity by Kathy Berberian, who was Luciano Berio's wife.
Absolutely. John heard her singing in the kitchen. He was staying with Berio when he visited the RAI studios, the studios of Italian radio, founded by Berio in the early 50s. And Berio invited John to visit in 58. He was staying with Berio. He heard Kathy Berberian singing, vocalizing in the kitchen, and he composed this piece for her.
That's so lovely. So, so lovely. Kathy Berberian's daughter lives in Los Angeles, and we've been in touch over the years since she moved here, which is quite nice. When you were talking before about the realizations of Fontana Mix with Langham Research Center, were those with aria, those the earliest ones, or was aria joined later?
Aria joined later. So it was something we performed. For example, we did a performance at the Tate Modern Gallery here in London using only John's tapes with no other devices. So just quarter-inch tape. Each performer, there were four of us, had the four tapes that made up Fontanamix in 1958. But we subjected it all to the score again. So they were the realization, again, was completely indeterminate. Uh-huh. And it doesn't sound like John, even though it uses John's tapes, it doesn't sound like John's realization. There are similarities, but it's not the same.
Right. That's fascinating. So that the content, if you will, is the same materials, but the organization of it, if exactly. you will, is different. That's yep. interesting. Yep. People ask that a lot, you know, the question having to do with, would you know something was a John Cage piece if you used the same materials, you know, like, for example, use the example of the vocal number pieces.
Yep.
And if you do two, take the same ensemble, same voices,
yep.
same piece, but have it be realized, of course, inevitably differently because it's a number piece, you still know it's a Cage work. But it sounds
yeah, absolutely. You know that from the energy, from the dynamics, from the shape, right. and from the pitches, because the pitches are actually specified in those number pieces.
Right, right. But how much of the distinction do you think comes from the? I don't know how to even call it. Maybe the when you say that they sound completely different one from each other, would they sound different in part because of the personalities of the performers? Is that part of what came through? Not at all.
No.
No.
Nothing okay. to do with personalities whatsoever.
Okay, good.
The score gives instructions on what is to be done. The score tells us what to do, not what we're going to hear. So this is one of the things we love about Cage scores, because we absolutely know what to do and when to do it. It's Perfect. Like a convention. It's like a Beethoven piano sonata. You know you've got to get these notes at this time, at this speed, at these particular pitches. It's very, very precise. And as John always said, he used chance operations in composition, so nothing would be left to chance in performance.
Right. That's very good. Very good. Well, you know, and it also speaks to the fact that there's no masterwork here. There's no single performance of any piece, Fontanamix included, where it is done better than the others, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Isn't that marvelous? And I love that about Cage's work.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. Indeed. It's interesting. I think I irritated John when I visited him in 1988. He asked me why I'd done this. He thought I was crazy. You know, this was 30 years after he'd made the piece. He said, Robert, why are you doing this? Why don't you get on with your own work? Why are you making a piece that I, you know, why are you realizing a piece that I composed 30 years ago? And of course, he'd moved on a long way. And this was all history as far as he was concerned, you know. And I said that I wanted to realize the score because I found the score fascinating. And I said, I wanted to know what it would sound like, completely made again from scratch. And I also said, and he really misinterpreted what I said. I also said, I heard his recording from the LP of electronic music, and I thought it was rather flat, is what I said, and two-dimensional. And in a way, it kind of is, because it's just in two loudspeakers, and there is no kind of stereo depth or any kind of... sort of in the 80s, it sounded very 50s. Uh-huh. And he was kind of, he was a bit cross with me. He said, you said my work was two-dimensional. I said, no, you're misunderstanding what I mean. I don't mean your work is, you know, I said, but my hearing of Fontanamix, you know, when I first heard it in the 70s or whatever, just this two-dimensional quality, these two loudspeakers making these sounds, I wondered if it could be made, if it would sound more modern. I was curious. That was the point. I was curious to see if I made it in 1987, would it sound different than it did in 1958?
Using the same means. The same means.
Using the same means.
Right. And did it?
And the answer is yes, it sounded different. It sounded different because I was making it, but again, it's nothing to do with me, the personality. It's a whole new reading of the score. So that's why it's going to have this different quality. But because I was using Cage's materials, you hear Cage's Sound World from 1958.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Shall we listen to a bit of it?
Okay, we're moving on to imaginary landscape number 5. Yeah?
That's right. So let's talk about imaginary landscape number 5. This is a work from 52, premiered in Cage's hometown, New York. It's short, so we'll probably play the whole thing, 4 minutes long, roughly. And this is for 42 recordings. So
absolutely,
the score could be realized as a magnetic tape.
Yes, indeed. It's for the production of a magnetic tape, so it is a tape piece.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about this piece when I was younger, and looking around for Langham Research Center pieces, looking around for Cage pieces that Langham Research Center could do, I came upon this piece. Now, as far as I know, there isn't available out there in the commercial world Cage's original realization, which was for jazz records. He used jazz records, and at the time he wasn't interested in jazz. He said he had no use for jazz, was his turn of phrase. But being John, of course, in order to engage with his dislike for something, he made a piece with materials that he felt he had no use for. So here he had a use for jazz eventually to make this realization.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated by this. There is actually out there if you search around on the internet, it can be heard. John's original.
We have an archival recording. I want to say it was done by Gene Erdman. We have that in our archives. So it was something.
I think it was done for her, wasn't it? Wasn't it made for her?
Exactly. Exactly.
I think it was. So I'm not surprised she made it. Anyway, I decided that I would make a realization. The score is very straightforward. It tells you for how long to play a record, when to change records, how to superimpose the records. And what I used was a wind-up gramophone phonograph from about the 1930s. Mm. And all of these records on this recording are 78s. They all run at 78 RPM. So this is from my collection of 78s. The other interesting thing is, a necessary thing is, they're all out of copyright. So all the recordings are out of copyright. A lot of the music will be recognizable because it's popular classics. I'm choosing popular classics. And I just followed the score. So I recorded 42 phonograph records and then followed the score, cut the recordings up, superimposed them as the score suggests, instructs, and what you get, what you hear is what you get. This is it. This is the piece.
This is a perfect example, though, of people might be mystified as to why one would do this without benefit of digital technology, because by using digital technology, it would be far simpler to cut and paste and to overlap and intersperse, et cetera, et cetera. No?
Yes, that's true. It would be probably much more straightforward. But for me, the process is very important. In realizing any of Cage's works, you have to go through the process. There are no shortcuts. And I am trying to get as close as I possibly can to the experience that John may have had. I'm not that interested in authenticity. I'm with Boulez on this, that you can never make an authentic performance of something that was done a long time ago. You know, so all that early music kind of stuff, you're playing this in the 21st century. You can never sound like a real Renaissance dance band. And I think it's the same with pieces from the 1950s. We have the same similar resources, but it's never going to be the same. So the point isn't to be authentic and try and be John Cage in 1952. The whole point is to be me in the 21st century, but being faithful to the score, being true to the score. And you just get much better results if you do that.
Right. No, I totally understand that. You know, we had a phenomenon here at the Cage Trust. This is years ago now, going back now to Williams mix. There were people who said, oh my God, I can do this with digital technology and I can do it with recordings on the internet and I can pull stuff, you know, I can get my source material just off the internet and I can, and then that was going on and people wanted to see the score, quote unquote, which was, you know, 600 plus pages of drawings of reel-to-reel tape and spliced dimensions and.
Yep. It's like a dressmaker's pattern.
It's amazing. It's just amazing. And one day, for the first time, somebody came to me and said that they were not interested using found materials like that, but rather they wanted to make it. And I said, you realize the amount of work you're talking about, you know.
Months and months and months.
Exactly. I said, maybe a year to do that 6-minute piece, you know, Cage's output. And the person said to me, and this is really a question to you, Robert, as a composer, the person said to me, no, I do understand that, he said, but I don't find much satisfaction in composing something that's so short and so simple to do that I really wanted to experience the long haul of it. You know, the way that Cage approached it, he wanted to try that. And I just thought that was fantastic. I thought it was fantastic.
It's that idea of going through the process. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. And again, in so doing, I'm not trying to be John Cage. I don't want to be John Cage. John Cage has already been John Cage. But he is a composer. John Cage, the composer. He's a composer, and he's composed these pieces just as much as Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven composed pieces. So these are works that I can play. These are works that I can realize. And I just find the sound world utterly fascinating. And so this is why I want to be engaged. And also, it then informs my work. You know, John said to me, why don't you get on with your own work? Why are you making these realizations of my pieces? But just as composers study the works of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven, or whoever, so I've studied the work of Cage and borrowed from it. I'm not trying, I keep saying this, I'm not trying to be John Cage. Right. There are things that he did that are useful to me, and there are other things that he did that are not so useful.
Of course, of course. And by the way, you know, the Cage Trust takes the position that what you're doing is what John Cage is doing now, meaning what you're doing with his work. That is what he's doing now. You know?
Yeah. So, it's his work.
Exactly. But it's his work now. It's his work as it's evolved through a culture, through a couple of generations of people. You know,
and performance practice. And these are performances, realizations and performances.
Yeah. Let's listen to a bit of this. Let's talk about WBAI, which is a strange work in Cage's catalog. This is a work from WBAI, New Yorkers would know that's New York's Pacifica station. It was composed in 1960 and again premiered in New York, his hometown, in 1960. And it's a piece that's actually performed with a lecture of Cage's called Where Are We Going and What Are We Doing? And you also used those recordings, yes?
This is a piece I knew very little about. And in fact, it still remains a mystery to me, even though we've made this realization. I'm still uncertain about what John's intentions were when he made this piece. The score speaks about the operation of machinery. So as in the making of Fontana Mix and other electronic works, the kind of things that John would do on tour with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, the operation of machinery, the operation of tape recorders and sine tone oscillators and shortwave radios, all those devices that John used, this score refers to those kind of devices. And again, he doesn't absolutely specify what is to be used, but we get, typically of Cage, we get a kind of rhythmic structure. He's concerned with temporal issues. He doesn't say anything about dynamics or any of those conventional musical characteristics or parameters. And there's a great little note, a footnote, if you like, on the score. It says, certain operations may be found impossible. For example, three or four at once. Let the operator do what he can without calling in assistance. And I just think that's fantastic because, and we did find that, you know, when we play this piece, there's a lot to do. There's a hell of a lot to do. And you don't always do it, which is generates indeterminacy. So every time we perform this piece, it's completely different. So this recording of the work, it's just one moment in time when we happen to play it when we made the recording. And when we've performed it in concert, it's absolutely different every time because we're using different resources each time.
Right.
But it still has that Cage quality.
It must be very glorious, though, in live performance because you're working with cartridges and open reel tape and things like that. You have a lot of theatrics going on, movement of the players with these machines.
Yes, exactly. It is extremely theatrical and dynamic, simply because there's a lot to do. And often, I think we've only ever done this with four of us playing. So there's a quartet of people desperately trying to get something done. And in a way, I guess it's a bit like playing in an orchestra, and I've not had a large ensemble experience. You know, when you're maybe playing at the back of the second violins, you're doing your bit. And yes, you can hear the effect of that, the overall effect in an orchestral piece. And it's very much like that with performing this piece. You're really focused on getting it absolutely right, doing your utmost. And maybe there is that moment when you can't do two or three things at once. So something just goes. You just can't get it done and you move on to the next event the next time. The next thing that has to be done. So that gives it a great deal of dynamism and uncertainty and fascination.
Right. You know, you remind me when you were talking about the inability to do what you're being told to do. It reminds me of that whole interaction that Cage had around one of the continuation of the Freeman Etudes books when Paul Zukav.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's impossible. And we heard Arditi play it, and it was so...
Here comes Irvin Arditi.
Perfect. And here's Irvine, and he said, and Cage went up to him and said, how is it that you can play this so fast? And number one, Irvine said, well, you say to play it as fast as possible. And Cage says, no, I know that, but how is it that you can do that? Because Paul Zukovsky had told him it was impossible. And Irvine said, oh, I just play as many of the notes as I can. You know, and John loved that. And he went on in books 3 and 4. I think he even put that in the score, you know, play as many notes as possible.
So absolutely.
I love that. But
do what you can. It's that pragmatism again. It's that absolute pragmatism. It's the antithesis of a composer like Stockhausen, for example, who would insist on every single event being managed absolutely precisely. And of course it can't be done. Right. And it's the same when you get to the so-called new complexity school of composers, when you have composers like Brian Ferneyhough, for example, his early scores particularly, this incredible kind of detail that's almost impossible to manage. So you do what you can. Right. It's pragmatism. You do what you can.
Right. But in Cage's case, what's so lovely for me is that doing what you can is exactly what's called for. It isn't, it's not a deficit. If you can only get to half of it, that's magnificent. You know, your half of it is magnificent.
But do your best.
Always. It's also funny that this piece is a radio piece, so that yes. it doesn't have the visual theatricality for most people hearing.
Yeah, but we do it in concert though. We actually play it, in a concert.
I've never
situation.
Heard it done live, so that would be great fun.
Yeah, call yeah, yeah.
Next time you do it, tell me. All right, let's listen to a bit of this.
Okay.
I mean, something I didn't say, Robert, is that you said the piece mystifies you a bit. You don't know much about it. That's true for almost everybody, I think. Most people have never heard this piece at all.
Philip Thomas got in touch with me before he was ill, of course. He got in touch and asked me about the realization because he was going to do it as well with students. Because John doesn't specify instrumentation, Philip was going to do it with acoustic orchestral instruments, and we exchanged information about our realization. He was trying to trace the history of the piece because I don't think John ever recorded this piece. I don't think it's ever been.
We have no archival materials at all about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the score is there, of course, and you can see the score is similar to scores he was producing at that time. It's a grid piece. Like Imaginary Landscape number 5, but it's a mystery. It's one of those pieces that's kind of out there and not much is known about it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to cartridge music. This is a piece also from 1960. It premiered in Bremen, interestingly. Cartridge music was used for the choreographic piece by Merce Cunningham called Changing Steps. There's a beautiful DVD, a video recording of that performance, I think, that was done at Sundance. I'm pretty sure it was done at Sundance on these wooden platforms. So you also get this sound of creaking wood interspersed. So why cartridge music for you? What was the fascination?
Again, this is a piece that I realized that I could perform, and it's for one to a large number of cartridges. I can't remember how many. Maybe it's eight, maybe it's more than that. The score fascinated me, and the resources fascinated me, the idea of using a simple phonograph cartridge. And of course, I thought, hang on a minute, 1960, John using phonograph cartridges, would he have used, when he originally made this, phonograph cartridges taken from a record player in 1960? Maybe not. Maybe he would have taken phonograph cartridges from old phonographs from a previous era. And the score mentions that a phonograph cartridge is an ordinary phonograph pickup in which customarily a playing needle is inserted. So this is pre-1960s technology, because we didn't have that knurled thumb screw and you put a steel needle in, or a thorn needle in some cases. So I began to research this, and by an amazing coincidence, one of those fabulous things that occurs when you're working with Cage's ideas, a good friend and colleague of ours, a guy called Dave Hunt, who's a recording engineer, who engineered this recording, had a friend who had a huge collection of these old phonograph cartridges from the 1930s. They're Bakelite, and they're really robust, and they're beautiful objects. And they needed restoring, you know, because these were old. These are from the 20s and 30s. So, for example, you know, little rubber grommets and little bits and pieces were all perished, you know, over 50 years later. And I found a man, a wonderful man called Adrian Tuddenham, who restores these old record players and old phonographs and all this old technology. And he completely restored these cartridges for us to play cartridge music. Marvelous. He had no idea what cartridge music was. He thought we were crazy. He thought we were just enthusiasts. We were enthusiasts, you know, people who collect phonograph records from that time. He hand wound all the coils, you know, redid everything in these cartridges, replaced the rubber grommets on which the moving coils sit, all that kind of stuff. He completely restored these devices. So we have these marvelous, wonderful, restored cartridges from the 1930s. And I wish, you know, just one of those things, I just wish John was alive again so I could ask him about his original ideas that he had in 1960. John, did you use old phonograph cartridges from old record players, or did you use up-to-date ones? I know in the Trust you have some cartridges, and I've asked David Berman about this and Kasugi about this, and the ones you have are more up-to-date. And David Berman said, yeah, because the old ones wore out. You know, when we were on tour with the Cunningham Dance Company, we used to go through these things all, because we performed this hundreds of times. So these cartridges were worn out.
Robert, didn't I years ago send you photographs of things that
we did.
Had here? Yeah, I do remember that.
You did. So you sent me the photographs, but those cartridges are more up-to-date cartridges. They're more from the 50s and 60s.
Interesting.
So it may be that's where those are the type that John used, or he may have used the kind that we use. So we had the resources. Here we are. We've got these amazing devices all restored, and we can perform this piece. And I was also acutely aware that this piece is the very first piece of live electronic music. Before that, everything was on tape. Right. All electronic music was on tape. And this is 1960, as late as 1960, the first piece of live electronic music, and a brilliant idea of using amplified small sounds.
Let's listen to a bit of cartridge music.
Okay.
You want to talk about minutes and 0 seconds?
4 minutes, 33 seconds, number two. Again, I was absolutely fascinated by this. I guess it comes out of Cage's interest in amplification of small sounds. So he did cartridge music in 1960. This is 2 years later. You know, he understood the possibilities of amplifying things that couldn't be heard with the ear alone. So I think he says in the score that his first realization is the sound of his pen writing the piece. And then the realization involved juicing an orange and drinking it with probably a Second World War throat microphone around his neck, amplifying the sound of that. Our realization involved making a cup of tea. Uh-huh. Which we thought was very Japanese, you know, the idea of not the Japanese tea ceremony exactly, but the sound of a boiling kettle, you know, coming up to a boil is amazing. This was the hardest piece to do. Uh-huh. This was the hardest piece to realize and get right, you know, because it's very, very difficult recording something as complicated as making a cup of tea. But we did our best, and the amplification is at maximum with no feedback, and the score calls for the performer to perform a disciplined action, fulfilling in whole or part an obligation to others.
Exactly. I myself did this piece in Scotland at the Edinburgh Botanical Gardens, where I sat in a chair with an empty chair next to me, and I put a sign on it that said, please sit here. And then whoever sat down, I would just have a conversation with them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
People were quite shy.
I'm sure.
All right. Let's listen to an excerpt from 0 minutes and 0 seconds. Let's move on to Variations 1. Just tell us what you did. Variations 1 has become a kind of signature piece for you and the Langham Ensemble, no?
Yeah, absolutely. We performed this in Japan in 2018 in in memory of John touring there in 1962. This piece was originally written for David Tudor for piano, but he says in the score that parts are to be prepared from the score with or without the extra materials, any number of players, any kind, and any number of instruments. So I saw this and thought, okay, we can do this. Again, pragmatism. I understand how this piece works. I realized Fontana Mix, it's similar, and there's transparent plastic sheets and dots and lines. Dots and lines, very conventional music. This is almost like a deconstructed, you know, conventional music score. And in this realization, we use a record player, cassette tape, radio, and there is spoken word. And the spoken word is from Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, which is a book we thought John may have enjoyed. I don't know whether he did. He used Finnegan's Wake a lot, and he used, you know, Ulysses and things, Joyce's text. So we deliberately chose a different author. So we made the spoken word parts by working through a page of the text using the score of Variations 1 to determine what would be read and the way it would be read in terms of dynamics and filtering. So the filtering is done electronically. In performance, we sometimes do the filtering simply by putting my hand over my mouth in this kind of way, or changing the sound of the voice in this kind of way. My colleague Philip Tagney normally does the reading. So this follows the score absolutely faithfully. And again, what you hear is what you get.
Right. You know, you said something earlier that struck me. I had the same thought, except only with regard to Cage's prepared piano music. And that is to say that Cage was, you know, I was trained as a classical musician. I was, you know, I was trained as, you know, I studied Beethoven and Schubert and whatever, as a singer and a pianist both. But what was interesting to me when I really discovered Cage was that it was the first time in my experience that I encountered a composer whose scores had no relation to what they sounded like in performance.
Yes.
And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. It was a big, yeah. It was a huge step forward for music in a weird way, because the
absolutely.
I couldn't, you know, as a musician, you're trained to be able to read a score, even an orchestral score, and read it and sort of hear it in your head. And the prepared piano music was certainly not like that. And that's true of all the tape works as well, is it not? You have no idea.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. So with the prepared piano music, you can certainly get a sense of the rhythm and the duration and the dynamics. But the timbre is uncertain.
Right, exactly. I even went so far as to think about, what if I played these pieces without preparing the piano?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what would they sound like?
Yeah, exactly that. So yes, that's one of the wonderful things about these pieces. Pieces like Fontana Mix and Variations 1, it's a process of discovery. You're going to make something that's never been heard before.
Right.
Even though it was composed in 1958 or 1960 or whenever, the outcome is entirely novel, entirely unique,
exactly.
Never been heard before.
Isn't
which
that
is
marvelous?
Astonishing.
As Cage would say, isn't that marvelous?
As John would say, isn't that marvelous? Exactly. And that's why we do it.
Thank you so much, Robert. Now on to a bit of Variations 1.
On the saddle, standing up towards his
ward, then suddenly in the
up the left hand pole.
I will do
gymnast. Do this leap.
Strength, agility, turning. Put it down and set his bow of the sad.
Self-sprung into the air.
Up.
Then tripped for his saddle and placed.
Then putting the thumb of the boat chain and up the horse's body. Then to turn heels over, head.
Him about like a 100 frisk, turns a dem god. Any. Me it has at times been in my
and the toe think it a little
having